CityCast from Explore City.
This is not a history textbook and not meant to be one. As you read it, you will understand why. It does look at various events which shaped India, and it tells of political personalities who make the essence of what India is and what it is not. While there is only one fact about any event or action, there can be many interpretations. Sometimes we snooze over facts, sometimes we gloss over the truth, and sometimes we create our own interpretation of what the reality is. But then, what is the truth about our land? What is the past that so many of us have no idea about, especially those young people who have come to take what they are told as the actuality? What does our history teach us? We need to examine such matters as far as possible without bias. But as human beings, we all have our own ways of looking at the world around. Certainly, there is a matter of perspective of the environment that has shaped our views and sculpted our understanding of our history. This book attempts to tell the history of us, our India. It tries to sift through the pages of our recent history and find an approach to that truth, especially in the last 7 decades since independence. Some of us, senior citizens now, were born just around our independence in 1947, Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children. We have seen our nation grow with us, and it is necessary to leave behind for posterity our understanding of that evolution. This book is principally for young people, our millennial and post-millennial Gen Z citizens, who take today's world and work for granted as if none other ever existed. In today's remarkable world of post-truth and fake news, we would hope you can find your own capacity to judge and place things in perspective. Our story is our way of looking at recent events in the history of India, not the only way, as we try to separate myths from fact as far as possible. So where do we begin in our book about modern India? We begin in 1857, when India was not one nation. As we do that, let us briefly remember its vastness, its diversity, and its unity, its all-embracing inclusivity. It is difficult to adequately describe India's plurality. Ours is an ancient land enclosed within definable geographical frontiers, where people have come through mountain passes to settle, to live and multiply, and to leave future generations in search of greater progress. It has always accepted visitors, though some were here certainly reluctantly. The British and the other Europeans, the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, who came to India, returned home quite unlike the way they stayed on in North America, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Why? The tropical weather was inimical to them, but as important was the fact that in India, in Asia, there were already people, lots of people. It was not virgin territory to conquer and settle in. Besides, the white and the brown did not quite mix. And yet, a few intrepid white men and women stayed on and loved our land even after independence in 1947, as did many million Muslims who preferred a secular state of India to the Islamic nation. India's diversity has meshed into a significant unified sensibility, but very recently, unfortunately, forces of divisiveness have sharply risen. The efforts made by our leaders at the birth of the nation to unify independent India need nurturing. Today, it is so easy to tear apart the bonds of togetherness, to break the unity and integrity that binds our land.
In What Is Meant to Be, his quiet and reflective corridor of retirement, my guest today, Abhijit Sengupta, grapples with the disquiet that lingers. A former senior IAS officer, and therefore you might say, a custodian of order and democracy, a lifetime of service to the nation has clearly left him with a profound sense of duty that refuses to retire with him. Abhijit's expression of angst a visceral response to the erosion of democratic foundations that he has cherished has resulted in his latest book, The Queen of All Nations. It's a response to what he sees as the foundation of democracy that are being visibly eroded with every news headline and each policy shift serving up yet another dissonant note in a score that he thought he knew by heart. It is understandably difficult for anyone to come to grips with the realization that the ideals that he held dear are slipping through the cracks of a society in a time of ideological polarization. And so, amidst all this angst, Abhijit Sengupta becomes a reluctant activist in this shifting landscape of incipient fascism and rising fundamentalism. But he channels his efforts not as a lament for the bygone era, but as something of a rallying cry for the return of ideals, with the optimism that the spirit of a plural democratic society can endure if those who believe in it refuse to be silent witness to its demise. The Queen of All Nations is more than just a historical narrative. It is a call for greater awareness of our own history and what got us here. And it's a poignant reflection on the anguish of this intellectual in a world that is grappling with new political turmoil. The book is a comfortable read, and it serves as a lighthouse for readers of the younger generation, whom Abhijit takes on a sweeping journey through the annals of modern India, delving into the little details of the political landscape and details also social upheavals and cultural transformations and events and incidents that have shaped the nation's identity today. There is another side to Abhijit, and that is his literary side. Abhijit's passion for language and its origins becomes evident, as showcased in his previous work, A to Z, The Origins of Select Words. I was delighted to have been given the opportunity to review this book, and there's a link in the podcast description to where you can read the review. And now to discuss his book, his ethic, and his state of mind, he joins me from his home in Bangalore, a city we share. Abhijit Sengupta, welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you, Ramji. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
You have been a senior member of the Indian Administrative Service for the defining part of your life and career. So let's talk administration. In your book, you mentioned that one of the roles of British administration in India was the unification of this landmass. Now, wouldn't you say that same exists even today with the Indian Administrative Service, that the effort is one of unifying this diverse ethnic polity?
Yes and no. Both actually are important. It's a typical phrase to use, yes and no. But I'll tell you the yes first and then the no. The yes is because Lord Macaulay in 1835 brought English as an administrative language into our country. And that spread because I think it was much easier for the South to accept English than to accept Hindi. But in any case, so when English came in, it became the language that was used. But so you do have the English version of administration spread throughout the world, throughout the country. And in any case, as a national language, for international purposes, you can't do without English. The government today is trying to sort of bring in Hindi a little more as an international language.
Let's go back a little in history. Now, there has always been such a thing as a court language, which was the language of the current ruler. So in Karnataka, for example, we have had three languages over the years, Kannada, Telugu, Tamil, and so on and so forth. In other places, we have had Persian and Urdu, etc. So under the British, wasn't English simply the court language?
Yes, certainly. The British language, which is English, did not get into the homes of the average person. That is why even today we do have our languages which have actually survived and are prospering, where Hindi has had the capacity to bounce back in a way as a language which our constitution makers had the foresight of saying there has to be an Indian language. It cannot be just English. Though we know that in courts, we know that in government of most, at least at senior levels, it's somehow because of our education system, we find it easier to to communicate in English, to express our thoughts in English.
Now, speaking of courts and languages and rulers, the term British is often used interchangeably between the East India Company and the administration by the Crown. Is there not a substantive difference in the definitions?
I think that's a very good point, very good question. Yes, there is a difference. The difference came about when we talk about the East India Company, the Queen's Company, or whatever form we use for the corporate segment of administration.
Mm-hmm.
Since 1857, or 1858 more technically,
mm-hmm.
when the British government took over, every time they talked of government, it was no longer the corporate administration. Every 20 years, the changes that the British made brought about in the Regulation Act and other acts along the way brought in more and more of governmental controls and reduced the control of the East India Company, which the government itself had given those days in the 18th century. So that's how it worked.
I'd like to jump to your book. Your book is a compendium of history and events that we have had to endure recently. And I would like to touch upon a few points that I believe are fulcrum points, inflection points in your narrative. So let me start with the first of them. I get the sense that you're saying that the VP Singh and Chandrasekhar governments were such turning points in recent Indian history.
Yes, actually that's true. And that's true because for the first time, the leadership from off Delhi came from people who were not from Delhi. We now today talk about governments or people from the south or east or west or whatever. Now today we have actually the present Prime Minister is not a Delhiite. And when he joined as Prime Minister, he did talk about the Delhi government and the Delhi. But it was these people, V.P. Singh from UP, Chandrasekhar again from UP, and a rural person who brought about this change.
So V.P. Singh and Chandrasekhar in many ways were what? The thin end of the wedge?
It's a tricky phrase to use, the thin end of the wedge. But I'll just leave it there to say only this, that these are two persons who came up in the turmoil of political mishmash
mm-hmm.
and that happened in those times. And you would probably remember talking of 1990, around that period, suddenly things had changed. Indira Gandhi wasn't around. We are talking today about a non-Gandhi family, Biradari and all that sort of thing. But that happened actually 30 years ago.
My point.
So there was that change, that others came back, that the Congress came back in its own way with the control, as it were, control in inverted commas,
mm-hmm.
by, say, the Gandhi family in its own way, was a different sort of thing. Yeah.
And speaking of things becoming fractious, you open a chapter on page 208 with these words, "People forgave Indira for the emergency, but not for Operation Blue Star." So what are we talking about here? I mean, it seems to me that we are speaking about a heart versus the head kind of thing. You know, Blue Star was an emotive issue and led to disastrous consequences.
Yes.
But the emergency was often seen as Indira ruling necessarily with an iron fist at the cost of democracy. Democracy be damned. Is that our ethic?
Yes, actually, it's like this. And I must say this, I've always wondered why that segment, a segment of Indians, talked or felt so much about Indira Gandhi's activities or inactivities. Actually, there's more of inactivity than anything else in the context of Blue Star and the whole process. But when it actually came to the death of Indira Gandhi, there was so much of that emotion. Just shows also how bottle cork suddenly came out. It was one of those terrible moments.
You know, I imagine that this is an example of how emotional our polity really is in terms of thinking with the heart than with the head. And in terms of being willing to put up with an unbelievable amount of autocracy, but will react publicly to the slightest emotional confrontation.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think for some reason, we are not a people who can sit down and think about the implications of what we are about to do or what we have done and what and how we should do things. We're a very emotional, emotive people. And I don't understand what it is. Maybe there is a genetic element to it. But otherwise, over the years now, especially in the last 100 years and of that last 70 years, we have grown more and more and more emotional about our response to political situations. It's just a very, very worrying thing, actually.
A few other such inflection points in your book. This during Rajiv Gandhi's time, two things specifically, Shah Bano and Babri Masjid. You were right there in the administration. So was Babri Masjid the first large-scale legitimacy given to fundamentalism?
It's a question of the largeness of that fundamentalism. If you look at the way the government, the then government, the earlier government of Indira Gandhi's, looked at the use or abuse of the Akal Takht by Bhindranwala and his group.
Right.
Where you knew that people who were militarized could go into the Akal Takht, that is something which is totally against the Sikh tenets from that point of view, was something that fundamentalism had happened. It did happen before that in any case, even more significantly during the partition.
Right.
And I mean, when we are losing millions of people beheaded and trains coming back and forth with dead people, this is much less of an issue. Yeah.
Right. I get what you're saying about scale. And on the second point, Shah Bano, a decidedly secular government of Rajiv Gandhi made decidedly unsecular moves. Who advised Rajiv Gandhi?
Yeah. That, frankly, I don't know. I was in Delhi in a significant department for some years, but I was very junior at that time, and I have really no idea who advised him. Because if I take names, it would be inappropriate on my part. I should not. I mean, you can guess, I suppose, who told Rajiv Gandhi to talk about "Hame banana hai." We know those days when he wanted a different government, different style of government, and then something else happened. He himself realized, yeah.
Now, to continue down the path of discussing secularism, my case is it's nothing new for us. Even if you were to move the clock back to, say, 1000 AD, during that time, the South, I imagine the rest of the country, already was living in a fairly pluralistic midst. So you had the Jews, the Christians, and before them the Jains and the Buddhists, and then after them the Muslims. All of them would have coexisted at that time, which means the administration of the country, whoever it was, whichever king was ruling, would have had to take into account all of these religions that coexisted in his realm. What changed?
It is changing because suddenly we find a very strong Hindu or a single religion, monoistic religion spread. And I'm not talking about issues of Sanatan Dharma within Hinduism or anything like that. But say the larger Hindu faith becoming more significant with the present political government. And that is something that is certainly important. On the other hand, I think all these religions in India are far too entrenched in the best sense of the term within our land for us to sort of say, we will get rid of this, we'll get rid of that. There are fools who say, who talk about send all Muslims to Pakistan. 200 million people? I mean, is that worse? That would be worse than the Holocaust.
Truly.
So that's the sort of a thing. Yeah. So that's the problem.
Speaking of the Holocaust, we are getting into matters of fascism here.
Yeah.
One thing that's becoming clear is that a lot of governments around the world are right-wing and the people are gravitating towards the right. And those surprising little elections where the left rules is seeming more and more like an exception rather than the norm. Your book touches on the possibility and the sentiment involved in these things. This, your views on this whole groundswell move towards more conservative politics.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. But I have a feeling that nothing can be permanent in our way of the human mind's working. Or the public of the day, and that includes the, it doesn't include the 100-year-old and a 5-year-old. That's why those who matter. And I would say from nowadays, it would be from 15 to 55 or 60, roughly that range. These are the people who have a very different way of looking at the world today than they used to maybe 50 years back. But the main reason for that is technology. It's not that the human mind has changed. Our push towards understanding things has changed because of technological changes. I mean, I lose a lot myself because I'm not technologically competent to do certain things.
Social media, it's converting rumor into fact. And rumor becomes the news, doesn't it?
How sad, isn't it? Just how tragic that, you know, this is like the Maya of the Hindu faith. What is truth? And then you go back to what is truth, said jesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer. This is the situation.
Let's talk about this. Because politics and elections are often decided in the fringes, yeah. Political expediency dictates that sometimes political rhetoric is very harsh. The question is to decide whether such remarks are being made from political expediency or from some deeply felt ideology. How to tell? Under what conditions would you be willing to dismiss fascist rhetoric as political expediency to a perverse degree?
But I don't think fascism can be used purely as a political stance. You have to believe in it to be able to create a certain world where a certain viewpoint has to be felt as the only view that matters. And I think Indians are basically very good-natured people. I mean, there is a dharmic element, but they are good people.
Sure, but while being a good people, I think that we are also a tribal people, and that's not unique to India. But whoever it is, being tribal also means having a tribal leader unto whom you will give unquestioning devotion and obedience. And it is natural for such leaders to try to turn the constitution on its head and suit their own purposes for whatever reasons, ideological, politically expedient reasons. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. I would. That when you look at a government which has an agenda, a religious political agenda, then you are not looking at the entire nation because you cannot, you are not fighting for the whole nation as a whole.
And when you point out such misdeeds, you come back to determining something about what are or what is the definition of misdeeds? Because for the people who are given unto tribalism, a litany of their beloved leaders' misdeeds would read as a list of their accomplishments.
Yes, I think that's very well put. You're absolutely right. It's a very interesting point that you make. It suddenly strikes me that that is correct. Yeah, that's an amazing...
On page 429 that I'm seeing here in the chapter, Recalling Fascism, you have an epigraph from Mussolini hitting this chapter, and it reads, "Fascism should be more appropriately called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power." Same thing in India, isn't it? Didn't we pretty much go completely out of control after liberalization? We were broke, we accepted conditions, and we liberalized the economy, but we were ill-prepared to administer it correctly.
Yes.
You were a part of the administration. Would you accept part of the blame for what's happened since?
Yes, I would. But one thing, as an individual, it was very convenient. It has always been convenient for me because on the 31st of the month, I got my salary. And then within 1 month of retiring, I started getting my pension, which I still get. It's a very convenient way of remaining untouched by this pressure or that pressure.
On corporatism. Please go ahead.
Sorry. I'll just quickly say I was a Masulini part of it. When I read, and I had to do a fair amount of reading about this, I was actually very surprised at Masulini's views on this. I knew it existed in that sense, but that he was so direct to say this, I didn't know that. I had to read it again, a second time, to say, yes, it's there, somewhere there. But you raised something else.
No, I think it's bang on topic, because it's just a matter of how prepared we were. I mean, you received training to be whatever job one picks up, and then there's something like this, like an earth-shifting thing, like liberalization happens, and when you're not ready, you're not ready. That's all. Things can just go haywire into the hands of people who are ready. And unfortunately, in my view, that wasn't the government. That is, in fact, the
good
case,
one.
Isn't it?
Good one.
And now to extricate ourselves, I'd like to talk to you about the book of etymology that you wrote, A to Z. I had the privilege to review it a few years ago.
Yes. Thank you for the review. It was a very pleasant review to read for me.
Oh, it was a very enjoyable book. So, literature, what drove you there?
There are two or three aspects to that. One is that when I went to college, I didn't know what to study, frankly. I should have, in retrospect, studied economics. Since I didn't know what to study, I said, okay, English literature. Because the only thing where I knew the daffodils and I knew some Shakespeare and typical senior Cambridge stuff. I did that. And then I didn't know that was a mistake. After some time, I wrote to my father. Those days you could send only telegrams. So I wish to change to history. So my father said, we prefer you stay with English.
And cut to the present, how did you come to write the books that you've written so far?
After I retired, I didn't know what to do. So I went and wrote three books. One of them is an online book. And an online, because there are some technical legal requirements why it's an online book and on drama and not anything else. It's an Indian writing in drama in English. It's available online. And then I wrote A to Z, which is actually a favorite of mine. The book we are discussing is not a favorite in the sense that it is something that I had to write. It just had to come, because I thought as a bureaucrat, I needed the people to know what we were talking about. But A to Z was a fun book of mine, and I enjoyed writing it. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed doing that.
For our listeners, Abhijit Sengupta's reference to the book on drama, it should also be mentioned that he is the husband of the famous playwright and novelist Poili Sengupta. And she was a guest on this podcast, and if you scroll, you will find the interview with her. Now, before we go, Abhijit, I need to step outside my zone and compliment your publisher on a really fine job, not just in terms of typography and printing, which are close to my heart, but I sense that there has been a real old-world traditional style of publishing that went into this book, a lot of collaboration, fact-checking. All in all, let me just say that to do this podcast, I have to read so many books, and I can tell when one of them stands out in terms of how well thought out and put together it is. So, my compliments to your publisher.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of the publisher, can I say thank you again. He has been remarkable. He has covered 900 footnotes personally. I must thank him, because it's been a labor of love for him as much as it has been for me.
It shows.
It is very remarkable.
Truly. And on that note, Abhijit Sengupta, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Literary City. I enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Ramji.
You have been listening to Abhijit Sengupta, author of the book, The Queen of All Nations. There's a link in the podcast description to where you can get a copy of the book. This book is not just wonderfully written and a great narrative of recent events, but is something to keep in your library as a great book of reference. And I'll be back with What's That Word? That fun segment where we look at the origins of words and phrases that we use all the time, but never stop to think about. Right after this. And I'm back. This is What's That Word? And this is my co-host.
Hello. My name is Pranithi, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
Hello, P with an A. You appear to be brimming with etymological wisdom today.
I am. I was doing my own research on Abhijit Sen Gupta, and I came across the article you referred to.
Which article again?
Yours. Your review of Abhijit's earlier book, A to Z.
Ah, yes, 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 yes. That was a fun book. I enjoyed reviewing it.
There's this line in your review that I want to quote.
You're quoting me to me?
Doesn't everyone else?
Frequently.
There. Okay. So here's the quote.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us live by the presumption that in life, some rules are necessary. Even a committed libertarian and most anarchist rebel would laud the government's efforts to install traffic lights at junctions.
Such wonderful prose, such wonderful wisdom.
I can't say the same for modesty, clearly.
Etymologically speaking, modesty, schmodesty.
Okay, fine.
So are you boiling up to make the segment about Abhijit's book A to Z?
We could, and I would love to go over that. But the fact is that people can simply buy that book and read everything he wrote.
That's very true.
Hey, could we add a link in the podcast description to that book as well?
Well, I think you should. Yes, please go right ahead.
Okay, done. Okay. For listeners, there's also a link in the podcast description to where you can buy a copy of Abhijit Sengupta's A to Z and a link to Ramji's review of that book to motivate you to go and buy it.
Thank you. Okay, let's get to it. All right, P with an A. So, what's that word?
Punctuation. Mm. Today, I want to discuss something we all take for granted. You know, the convenient full stop or period.
Well done. And that is a good topic, period.
Thank you. Let's do it then. The etymology, please.
The etymology of which?
Both of the punctuation itself and of the name, full stop and period.
Got it. Okay. All right. Let me start with how this dot, which is how I'll refer to it, found its way into written English. And for this, we start with its origins in Greece. The first sighting of this particular punctuation is said to be in the works of Aristophanes of Byzantium, and that is in the 3rd century BC, okay?
Okay, right.
So, in the system, the Aristophanes system, there were a series of dots whose placement determined their meaning.
How so? Different dots? Not like the full stop at the end of a sentence?
Yes, and well, not really. You know, in his system, he used three dots. The full stop at the end of a completed expression, which we know today as the full stop, he used a high dot, and that is called the stigma tilea, or the terminal dot, he called it, and it was aligned to the top of the line, not the bottom of the line. Then he had a middle dot, and that dot marked like a division in thought. Now, division in thought within a sentence is a semicolon. That's what we use today as a semicolon. And then he used the low dot or the under dot, and that's not so much as two different thoughts, but just a little pause in the sentence in the reading. That was what we know today as the comma, and that, what Aristophanes used, was the OG comma.
OG comma.
It's a medieval expression.
Sure. Whatever you say, OG. So the comma became the full stop.
Yeah. Yes, it did. The terminal dot survived all the others. And come the 9th century, scribes thought, hey, why stay high when you can go low? Anyway, now by the time of printing, you know, Gutenberg, printers started preferring the lower dot because it was easier for typographers, or rather typesetters, what's it, compositors, that's what they were called. And that became the standard full stop that we're all chill working with today.
OG, chill, what's with you today?
I'm too young to say groovy.
That's funny. But I wish we would all use groovy. It's such an interesting expression.
Word.
All right. So could you tell me more about the other punctuation? Oh, and more importantly, the names, full stop and period. Is the difference in usage merely British and American?
Right. Okay. I'll start with the names. So first, to answer your question, yes, full stop is British and period is American.
By that, shall I assume that full stop predates period?
In terms of modern usage, yes. But the full stop for the punctuation mark might be slightly older than period, but really both date back to the 16th century. Now, period comes from the Latin periodus, which means complete sentence, which again apparently has some throwback to Greek, where it was supposed to be an event that had a finite beginning and a finite end. Exactly how period went from this to referring to the dot at the end of the sentence is of great mystery, but it doesn't take a great leap of faith to figure out how that happened.
That is so interesting. But tell me about the punctuation itself. You know, did the other punctuation follow similar etymological paths?
In a sense, yes. So let me sum this up. You know, back in the day when people wrote fancy manuscripts, they used an ivy leaf in the margin to show an end of a section. And that was the para of the graphos. Get it?
Totally. Para and graphos equals paragraph. Fascinating.
Now, the Romans had no punctuation at all.
What? Really?
Yes. They wrote words without spaces between them. And, you know, people had to know the context. They were all very learned in those days. So they had to know the context, and they would know from that where one word ended and another word began. And by the way, all the letters were just one size, huge.
And whom did this help?
No one. In the 6th century, when monks finally took up the task of being church scribes, they needed to speed up writing. So they switched to a cursive style as opposed to the Roman block style, right? So cursive style meant they ran letters together and they used minuscules. Minuscules means small letters to write faster. So it was not like everything was inscribed in all caps and so on, like you're shouting at somebody on text these days. Anyway. To make reading easier, they started putting a dot between each word. And they needed something more to mark the end of a thought, you know, inspired by the Roman rhetoricians. So the monks began using three dots, which we know today as the ellipse, and a big letter to signify a new thought, which was the capital at the beginning of a sentence.
Wow.
Later, a clever monk realized that the dot wasn't really necessary. The space between words just worked fine. So what do they do with the dot? So the dot then took on new roles over a word or a pause, and after a word for, you know, like equivalence or something like that, and under a word for periodus, and voila, those dots are the ancestors of our modern comma, colon, and full stop.
That is completely fascinating. One little dot. So much history.
Most of this from a book published in 1849. It was by a Frenchman called J.H. Chauvier, and his book is Treatise on Punctuation. It was translated from the French in 1849.
Have you read this book?
Yes, I have it. And there are many variations available online.
Cool. But tell me, hasn't texting and the character limit on Twitter started hurting punctuation?
True, it does. But things have a way of surviving. And the full stop is used as an emphasis in texting. Have you noticed?
Not really. How? Give me an example.
Okay, here's one example. Let's say that you broke off a dinner engagement with someone. And I assume you do that frequently. And texted that person saying so. He might reply with, fine. Now, if he wrote fine with no punctuation, it might mean no problem.
I have a feeling this is going to get funnier.
I'll try. So if he puts an exclamation at the end of the word fine, it might signify enthusiasm.
Enthusiastic that I broke a dinner date with him. What a swine.
Truly. But if he wanted to show that he was really pissed off, he might reply, fine, full stop.
Ouch, that's chilling.
Exactly.
Wow. So the period can be used to signal the end of that conversation too.
Yes, it could.
But I'm not going to say bye, full stop.
No?
No. I will happily say bye.
And that's our show. I'd like to thank my guest, Abhijit Sengupta, and my co-host, Pranati P. with an A, Madhav, and all of you for being here and for listening. Till we meet again, have fun. This is Ramji Chandran, and this is The Literary City.